In a proposed bill, State Senator Laura Fine would require hospitals to file plans with the state in case they stop or suspend services.
The state is really stepping up to make sure that our hospital system is strong.
Instead of offering burial or cremation services, we are transforming bodies into nutrient-rich soil.
Natural organic reduction, more simply known as human composting.
Hey, Chicago, I'm Patrick Smith in for Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Lawmakers in Springfield are taking a serious look at these sudden closures of hospitals. Mayor Johnson has some new faces heading up key departments in Chicago, and the teens are on the mind again.
Chicago City Council Committee on Public Safety met today to talk about stopping teen trends.
In the spirit of love and unity towards our young people, we want to make sure that they're safe while using these devices.
Mayor Brandon Johnson has chosen Ann Jeanette Young to sit on an oversight board for the Chicago Police Department.
Brewer says Burnett isn't qualified. The board doesn't want him, and Pettigrew is a, quote, rock star.
I think he's disappointed because he didn't get the candidate that he wanted.
Before we get into the conversation, Sun-Times reporter Caitlin Washburn, who's one of our panelists today, joins us now to share what she's learned about the closing of a local hospital in Oak Park. Hey, Caitlin.
Hey, Patrick.
Okay, Caitlin, you've been covering this story for a long time, going back to last summer when Weiss Hospital in Uptown closed. Tell us what the connection is between Weiss and West Suburban Hospital.
These two safety net hospitals are owned by the same company called Resilience Healthcare, and the CEO and owner, Manoj Prasad, runs both hospitals. Weiss is now closed, and now West Suburban is temporarily closed. But Prasad purchased the hospitals in 2022 from Pipeline Health, which was a private equity company that owned those hospitals, and Westlake Hospital, which Pipeline closed Westlake Hospital before selling West Suburban and Weiss to Prasad in 2022.
So Prasad owned and ran these two hospitals that had sudden closures. What has been the impact on the community to have this sudden closure of West Suburban in Oak Park?
Like I said, it's a safety net hospital, which means you're serving low-income people. You're serving people who don't have access to healthcare or aren't close to another hospital or a doctor's office. So it's been pretty devastating for the community to lose both just a place to go for doctor's appointments, but then also for people who were in the hospital who were there for treatment or for surgeries. They also have a cancer center. So people were going there for chemo treatments, and it just this sudden closure. You know, I'm still trying to find some people to talk to. I've talked to some patients and some concerned community members, but I'm looking to understand what this impact has felt like. But just in the immediate aftermath, people have been really affected by this.
So if somebody had their medical care canceled, if someone they love was going to West Suburban, how do they get in contact with you to tell their story?
Yeah, you can reach me on my email, which is kwashburn@suntimes.com. My last name is WASHBURN@suntimes.com.
Caitlin, thank you so much for stopping by to fill us in on that. Looking forward to your future reporting. There's so much more news to get to, so let's dive in. Thanks again to Caitlin. Also at the table to help make sense of the week's news was Quinn Myers, Block Club Chicago reporter covering Wicker Park, West Town, and Bucktown, and Monica Ang, Axios Chicago reporter. I think the top story this week was not super local, but was, of course, Iran and our war in Iran and Lebanon. There's a tenuous ceasefire in the war in Iran and continued bombing in Lebanon. Several Illinois Democrats have joined the growing calls for President Trump to be removed from office. That includes the governor, Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton, who's running for Senate, Representative Delia Ramirez, Lauren Underwood, Mike Quigley, Jan Schakowsky, Sean Kasten, Raja Krishnamoorthy. We talked with Representative Bill Foster on Say More about this. Monica, I'm going to start with you. These Democratic politicians, are they just scoring political points here, or do they have a point that our president is unable to make rational decisions?
Well, Patrick, you know, as journalists, we have no opinion about any of these things. But I would just, you know, read some of these truth posts that the president put out around Easter, saying a whole civilization will die tonight, never to be brought back again. And open the effing strait, you crazy bastards, or you'll be living in hell. Just watch. You can decide, the listeners can decide if maybe someone's mental faculties could be questioned when they post that.
Okay, we don't have opinions. We do have human emotions. How did you feel when the president posted a whole civilization will die tonight?
I personally felt scared. Just what that means for people in Iran, for us, for the entire world. You know, in terms of politicians locally condemning it, I do think it's both. Like, they want to score political points, but I also genuinely think a lot of these Illinois Democrats believe that Trump is unfit for office and should be removed via the 25th Amendment. How that actually happens is unprecedented, right? We you know, hasn't ever been officially used, and there's some murky legal territory there over who would initiate that.
And so legislatively, with Republicans still dominating Congress, it's probably iffy if it'll pass.
Yeah, I mean, saying a whole civilization will die tonight is extremely alarming. I think it should be for even the supporters of the president, right? So I think that people in Illinois, politicians are going to continue to push, like Governor Pritzker, for his ouster. Not sure it's going to lead anywhere, but we're going to be hearing that rhetoric more and more, especially going into the midterms.
I will note there are three Congress members, Republican Congress members, who represent parts of Illinois: Mike Bost, Darren LaHood, Mary Miller. For Say More, we reached out to them to have them on the show. They didn't respond. We asked for comment on the president saying a whole civilization will die tonight. They didn't respond to that either.
Which often happens when something like that comes out of the White House. I reach out to all three, and it's usually crickets.
Caitlin, let's get more local here and a little less apocalyptic. Some people have been questioning Mayor Brandon Johnson's decisions. We've seen a lot of upheaval among his staff. On Wednesday, Johnson announced several new hires. Can you walk us through some of the most important staff changes?
For sure. He announced 9 new hires on Wednesday. A couple of the key ones, Garyon Gatewood was fired from as deputy mayor of community safety, which was a rather abrupt firing, and especially after all the credit that he was given and his office was given for reducing violence in the city. The new deputy mayor for community safety is Emmanuel Andre. He comes with a pretty packed resume when it comes to restorative justice practices. He most recently was at the Cook County Public Defender's Office. Another notable one is he picked his new commissioner for the Chicago Department of Transportation. That'll be William Cheeks Jr. They did have a temporary guy, Craig Turner, who had been the acting commissioner since July, I believe, and then several other new hires as far as the deputy mayor for health and human services, and who also is serving as the director of the mayor's office of homelessness. Notably there, Cindy Soto, who was the chief homelessness officer for the city, recently left that post. The mayor's office says that was always going to be a temporary job because it was grant funded.
I'm curious about this, the firing Gatewood, Emmanuel Andre. Does anybody have insights into what this could mean for community safety in Chicago?
I think it's too soon to say. I think, probably we'll continue on the public safety plan that the mayor says has led to a historic drop in homicides. What I think is interesting about this announcement is the mayor has been under a lot of fire about these appointments or not having permanent leaders, both at the sister agencies and at City Hall, right? So we're finally seeing some movement. You know, CDOT, the transportation department, is one of the city's biggest and most important and public-facing departments. It's been without a permanent leader for almost a year now. So finally, we have someone coming in here who still has to be approved by the city council, we should note. But again, there's still a fair amount of turmoil at the sister agencies. I mean, CTA is without a permanent leader. We finally just got one at CPS. CHA, it's unclear if you could say whether or not we have a permanent leader at the moment because of what's been going on over there. So I think this is where the mayor has gotten a lot of flack, being like, this is your job to basically appoint people and have them run these departments and run the city. And it's been a lot of interim positions for a long time now.
Go ahead, Monica.
And I think sort of the larger picture is that these sister agencies are revolting. We're seeing some pushback from Eklund King over this May 1st, things that maybe we'll talk about later. You're seeing a lot of pushback from the board at CHA. You're seeing all this turnover and then all of these claims for people who've left or been pushed out, that there was retaliation and hostility. I mean, I think it points to a lot of chaos on the fifth floor.
You said Eklund King, just for people that is the head of Chicago Public Schools. Quinn, you talk about CHA, the Chicago Housing Authority. Caitlin, let me ask you about that. There's still a lot of drama, as Quinn was talking about who is heading the Chicago Housing Authority. get us caught up, because Quinn, you just kind of flew right through that. Caitlin, catch us up here on what's going on at the CHA.
There is a lot of drama. So the CHA board rather abruptly appointed a new CEO, and they didn't say it on their agenda. And this is mm-hmm. a point of contention with a lot of folks right now. It just said updating personnel matters, and they went into closed session, and they came back, and then they voted publicly for the new CEO. And housing advocates are pretty upset about this. You know, why they're upset, they say, is because they don't think the board followed the Open Meetings Act, which requires public notice on decisions like this. And because the agenda was so vague and they didn't make that clear, you know, there's also a question if they would rather a different person in the post. You know, that could also be their motivation. But in a press conference this week, they did say, you know, we're happy with anyone or anyone who's willing to meet with us, but we just want the process to be followed.
And this is not who Mayor Brandon Johnson wanted to head the CHA, right?
That is right. Mayor Johnson's pick,
Walter Burnett.
Walter Burnett, that's right.
Yeah. And what happened there? I mean, this is another example of what Quinn's talking about, right? Where Mayor Johnson is not getting his preferred choice to head agencies that in the past, the mayor kind of got to pick, you know, the leadership and more or less was in charge of.
Yeah, that's why I'm seeing it's such a sea change from former mayors who ruled with an iron fist. And here's who I want for CPS, CHA, CTA. Not happening anymore. There's a lot of pushback. He wanted Walter Burnett. Walter Burnett, his appointment, if it was ever going to get close, and that still remains to be seen, was slowed down with waivers that needed to happen because mm-hmm. of conflicts, because he and his wife owned some properties that had people using CHA vouchers.
So I am curious about that, about Mayor Johnson and advocates having sort of different reasons for being upset over how the CHA picked its leader. We will see where that happens, because as you said, there's a court case now over how this was chosen. Quinn, I wonder if I could ask you, stick in this sort of kind of the same realm here, about the City Council Zoning Committee.
Right.
I'm going to admit, even as a journalist who knows how important the Zoning Committee is,
we're nerding out.
I start to sort of doze off as we're talking about Zoning Committee Chair.
Absolutely.
But this is important, right? The Zoning Committee is a big deal.
It is important because basically every development goes through this committee to get city approval, to work with the Department of Planning, and then aldermen basically get to say whether or not they think it's a good project. There's a lot of interesting, you know, intricacies in that process. So the zoning chair is a very powerful aldermanic position, and it's been Alderman Bennett Lawson, Lakeview Alderman, has been doing it on an interim basis, actually mm-hmm. in two stints because of various city council machinations, which we don't necessarily have to get into. He was still the interim zoning chair, and earlier this year he said, enough, I've been doing this as an interim basis. I don't have the proper resources or the access that comes with the permanent position, so I demand to be basically made permanent. That got some pushback from the Black caucus, the Latino caucus in the city council. The backdrop is, historically, as we've been talking about, the mayor has had—
We should say that Bennett is white.
He is white. The mayor has had wide latitude to basically ram through his committee chair positions to do—
I'm sorry. His name is Bennett Lawson. He represents Lakeview. I'm just kidding. Sorry, go ahead.
and that's why the Black and Latino caucus said, hey, what about representation for us?
Yeah. Right.
That's the important context there. The context with the mayor is that, you know, he, in the past, mayors have said, this is who I want leading my city council committees, and therefore they can, you know, enact my agenda. That hasn't happened here as strongly. Mm-hmm. And so finally, Lawson says, next week at the city council meeting, he will basically force a vote to make himself the permanent zoning chair for the rest of the term, which is about a year, right? It seems like he probably does have the votes finally to do this, although we'll see what happens on Wednesday. But hopefully at some point soon, there will be another zoning committee meeting, because there are a lot of big backlog, essentially, of projects that need to get city council approvals, ranging from big apartment towers to, you know, can I add this unit to my two flat, that kind of thing.
So I know you can't, you know, speak for it's a lot of different groups, but of the interests who deal with the zoning committee outside of city council, is this what they want? They want Bennett Lawson to get this permanent position?
It seems like at least the business interests definitely do. I mean, he, you know, has been doing this on and off for a long time. He actually was the chief of staff for Tom Tunney, former Lakeview alderman, who Bennett Lawson replaced in the 44th Ward, and he essentially helped run the zoning committee under Tom Tunney. So he does have a lot of experience here.
Before this zoning committee delay happened, Quinn, the city council voted last year to allow accessory dwelling units citywide. Some people call them granny flats or coach houses. This new program launched this week. but there are quite a few restrictions. I'm counting on you for the details here.
Sure. I think we should get rid of granny flats. Like, does anyone actually say that? You know?
No, you're right. Everyone's always saying ADUs. That's what we should say instead.
Correct. I've been going with coach houses and basement units as a broader. So yeah, so essentially this has been a long time coming. You know, for years there's been this pilot in certain parts of the city to allow property owners to build an ADU or legalize a basement unit or other unit without having to go downtown and get a zoning change, which is a whole process, as we kind of just discussed. That has been expanded by the city council pretty broadly across the city, although there are still restrictions. Not every single family zoned area allows them. Some do. Aldermen have opted in some places. In other places, there are additional restrictions. You'll need certain elements of city oversight, or you, as a homeowner, you'll have to live there. So you can go look that up online. It's very confusing. They created this patchwork instead of creating this blanket set of rules. You know, one block might have these rules, another block might have these rules. So there are various websites, and the city has a website. And actually, I interviewed this guy from Logan Square who created this aduchecker.com, which allows you to go in and see, like, okay, can I actually do this? It's pretty cool. But it is confusing. So I if you want to build an ADU, I recommend kind of doing a lot of research first, because it can be an expensive process and you want to make sure you're actually eligible. And the city has to pre-certify you. So there's this whole process.
Do we have Chicago property owners on the panel? Anybody planning to build a basement dwelling?
Well, you know, I was thinking of putting it above my garage. I'm in Lakeview, and I think I'm one of the few houses on the block that does not already have one, because these were pre- other laws. Mm-hmm. And so, like, everybody's renting out to some kid who just graduated from the Big Ten living over the garage. I want to do that too. But I was already a part of the pilot group pre this law.
Okay.
So why haven't I done it? I don't know.
Well, there's still time. One story I wanted to note: Chicago is not the only one getting new homes. Over 200 new homes will be built at a long empty factory site in Highland Park. It's the largest number of new homes for sale in decades in the northern suburb. Cranes reports the new development will go on what was once the Solo Cup manufacturing facility, which closed 18 years ago. I had no idea that Solo Cups used to be manufactured in the Chicago region. Pretty interesting. But Monica, let's move from the north suburbs to south suburban Lynnwood, which made headlines this week over a roller skating meetup. What happened here?
Well, there was supposed to be a roller skating meetup, which actually sounds quite fun.
It does, and wholesome.
Yeah. but apparently, the online comments on social media were, this is going to be, you know, like a violent party. I didn't see them, but that's what the police chief said. He said all sorts of threatening comments on social media that led him to believe that this was going to be a teen takeover. So it was canceled. And then the other location, it was going to be moved to a bowling alley. It was canceled there as well. But Nicole Gooden, who is widely believed is going to be running for mayor of Harvey, she was going to be holding a rally there. And she said, this wasn't going to be a teen takeover. What are you talking about? And so there's all this debate about, did you shut this down for political reasons, or was it really going to be a teen takeover? Who made those comments about this is going to be a violent situation? And I think for Chicagoans, it kind of brings up this larger question of, How do you really hit the right note when it comes to preventing teen takeovers that could be a problem? Mm-hmm. Because Chicago's had a really big problem with that. You know, we had the event in March where we saw 24 citations and 8 arrests downtown. And when I FOIA'd how many arrests had happened downtown over the past 5 years, and it had only been, you know, an average of about 20 a year or less, sorry, 10 a year. So it had doubled overnight. Mm. So Chicago does seem to be much more aggressive about when I say citation, it's like, what happened to me? Hey, you're out too late, Monica. We're taking you down to the police station. My mom had to come and get me. Not recently.
Wait, were you participating in a teen takeover?
It was a fraternity party at Loyola University, and I was 16 years old. I shouldn't have been there. Mm. But I got taken by the cops. My mom did have to pick me up. It was very embarrassing. But they hadn't done that much downtown. It was all this hoopla. Oh, let's change all these laws downtown because downtown is where this happens. There had only been, I believe, 40-something over a long period of time. But overnight, they did 24. So it seems like they're cracking down. But will we see Alderman Hopkins reintroducing some sort of earlier legislation? Because the whole point of it is 10 o'clock, right? They want the power to do it earlier.
Right. And I should say Alderman Hopkins, who has introduced and been pushing this idea of a snap curfew where the police or somebody can say, you know, all kids off the street because of these so-called teen takeovers.
And there's been various revisions where, you know, there would be, I think the latest version, more time given notice, you know, not the so-called 30
something
minutes.
Something like 12 hours.
Yeah, you know, there's been various revisions. But yeah, essentially.
Okay, so Monica told her story. Caitlin or Quinn, have either of you ever participated in a teen takeover?
I have not. I did get in a little bit of trouble as a kid, too. And, you know, I benefited from probably white privilege, got a slap on the wrist, and you know, had my record expunged for a misdemeanor, which we don't
and
have to get
now
into.
You're and here it on the air.
Exactly. So yeah, I mean, it's an ongoing question of what is the right balance to keep people safe and also not limit people's freedom. And you know, we have not totally figured this out yet.
Right. And to Monica's point, there has been real mayhem. There's been real trouble. There have been shootings at things that have at least been described as these teen takeovers before. This is a real thing. But also, it can get into that demonizing young people, especially demonizing young people of color. And if you can just say it's a teen takeover, you should be terrified. I could see that being a troubling, I don't even know if it's a slippery slope. We might already be sort of at the bottom of that mountain now. Lawmakers are back in Springfield. Tell us about a bill that would require hospitals to submit more detailed financial statements. This is a response in some way to the sudden closure of West Suburban Hospital in Oak Park, right?
That's right. To pull back just a little bit, West Suburban closed temporarily, rather abruptly a few weeks ago. And that took a lot of people by surprise. And myself and Kristen Short started digging into this. And we very quickly learned that the owner, despite this being a surprise and, you know, a troubling situation for the community, the guy followed the law. State law requires you to, if you're going to temporarily close, you just have to give notice within 30 days of that closure and you have to send regular updates. But that's, you know, that's about it. And there's no response that the state can have. There's no discipline. There's no, there's nothing that they can really do to this guy. So in response to this, to be fair, this, some of this stuff had been in the works, but you know, it's a part of a larger question of how do we handle safety net hospitals closing, but especially safety net hospitals, especially as we see more cuts to Medicare and Medicaid coming down the line. So these bills, there's two of them. One would require a hospital like West Suburban to submit a plan before they close or when they close, as far as this is focused around patients and what and how to support patients. Mm-hmm. When you suddenly close, where do you go? Who's your new doctor? If you had a, like, for a lot of patients, they had surgery scheduled at West Suburban. What are they supposed to do? Like, there's Rush Oak Park, there's Loretto, there's, you know, hospitals in the city, but at the end of the day, like, you're then entering a new pool of patients, and that's, you know, that is not easy to do. So the hospitals would have to have a plan to do that. The second thing is to require financial information from these for-profit private hospitals. Nonprofits have to share a certain amount of information with the states. These nonprofit private hospitals do not. So another bill would require financial audits, quarterly statements, and then also showing that they have reserves in the bank in case they do close, or if, like in the case of this, of West Suburban, the owner said they were operating on 10% of their revenue. Like, so that means they had no savings, they had nothing in the bank, and they were operating on truly, I mean, less than a shoestring.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where, obviously, these are, as you mentioned, for-profit private companies, so they can close, but it does feel like something that, like, shouldn't be allowed, that a hospital can just close when you've got a surgery scheduled or you are in the middle of care that is necessary for one reason
cancer
or another.
Cancer treatment. A lot of they have a cancer center at this hospital, and, like, literally patients getting chemo drugs can't get their treatment anymore.
Is there, does it seem like this legislation is going to pass this session?
That's a good question. We'll see. Especially with news like this, it does put pressure on lawmakers to do something. So we'll see. It's still very early. There are lawmakers and advocates and just people in the community are hopeful that there can be more guardrails to prevent this from happening.
So you mentioned you've been digging into this story. I mean, going back to at least last summer when Weiss Hospital in Uptown closed. Tell us more about the CEO of both Weiss and West Suburban Hospital, this Manoj Prasad.
Yeah, so he bought both hospitals in 2022 from Pipeline Health, a private equity company. And he came in also with he has owned other hospitals as a private equity executive, and this seems to be something that he's done a lot in other states. So he came in, he bought West Suburban and Weiss.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the way that he says it is he did assume a lot of debt buying these hospitals. I mean, Pipeline, these hospitals were already in trouble, out of fairness. Like, they were not doing well. He did not buy stable hospitals. And he says that he worked to bring them in the black and get new equipment because they had a lot of aging equipment issues and staffing problems. And it doesn't seem like it's really improved under this guy. So he closed the labor and delivery unit at West Suburban about a year ago, which is pretty devastating for a community to lose a birthing center. There's not really anyone nearby. I believe Loyola is the closest one, but a lot of community hospitals, because labor and delivery is you don't make money bringing babies into the world, which is unfortunate that they see it as a bottom line issue, but it's one of the more expensive and least return units in a hospital.
There's no money in babies.
There's no money in babies.
I know what a great reporter you are, and you're working with Christian Shores, also a great reporter, but you've actually had trouble finding information out about Dr. Prasad, right? Including, I just said Dr. Prasad, but do we know where he went to medical school?
He finally, in a press conference a couple weeks ago, said that he did go to medical school in India. He has not been a practicing doctor in many decades, so there's no active license for him. And it's unclear if he's actually ever practiced medicine in the United States. And then as far as him ever working as a doctor, we don't have a lot of clarity on that.
Monica Quinn, I mean, a CEO of two hospitals not being a licensed doctor, this seems weird, right?
I don't know if it's a requirement necessarily, but I do think, you know, he should be transparent about his background and his qualifications, especially if he has closed down two safety net hospitals that, you know, lower income Chicagoans and people in the suburbs rely on every day. I think, were you at the press conference? I wasn't there, and I heard it was quite chaotic, to say the least.
And even more important than his doctor credentials, what about his solvency? I mean, is there enough money to actually pay the staff? And so these proposals seem to suggest that, maybe we should know. Are they on the brink of closing?
Monica, you took a look at another piece of legislation that's being considered in Springfield that may not be on everyone's radar, which is human composting. Mm-hmm. Explain that to me.
Also called natural organic reduction, it's when you take the remains of someone who's deceased and turn them into soil, about 1 cubic yard of soil. Not legal in Illinois at this point, but it is in 14 other states, mostly on the East and West Coast. And for those who are sort of green-minded, it can reduce the emissions caused by cremation. It can reduce the toxic fluids that go into the ground from embalming when you bury someone. But so the provision is on the table in Springfield. Mary Beth Canty has proposed it. It passed a House committee, and now it has to move on to the full House and the Senate. But the Illinois Catholic Conference, not into it. Testimony saying that it basically degrades the human.
Doesn't it literally degrade the human?
I guess when they say it, but also figuratively, it's not respectful. They say cremation and burial, on the other hand, allow for sort of the whole person to stay together. And there is this belief that in the resurrection, we will all be resurrected, and you don't want like part of your body to be over here and part of it over here. Harder to resurrect.
You'd be coming back looking funny.
Yeah, and that seems to be the suggestion. So, but then Mary Beth Canty says, look, if anybody doesn't want to do it, they don't have to do it. We simply want people to have a choice to have this happen.
Because right now people are traveling Is that the right word?
You have to move the body. You have to fly the body.
You said this is legal in other states?
Bodies are being taken to other states for this process to happen.
Right. And a longtime Chicago environmental radio host, Mike Novak, he testified for what is sometimes being called Kathleen's bill, because his wife, Kathleen Thompson, playwright, passed away in 2024. Her body had to be flown out to have this process done.
All right, Monica, let's stick with composting, but not human composting. You took a deep dive into composting. What does the data tell us about, in Chicago, who is composting and where?
Well, I have to say, shout out to Lincoln Square.
Okay.
Because they are the top neighborhood for signing up for these composting sites. So you don't have to sign up and register in order to bring your food scraps to all these green bins that are in 33 locations in the city. But the city really wants you to, so they know how many bins to put out. Mm. And the neighborhood with the top sign-ups is Lincoln Square. I have to say Avondale, which was mine for a long time, also did quite well. But Logan Square, surprise, surprise, Edgewater did really well. And so I got the data, I FOIA'd the data on who had the top signups and also the tonnage. Since the program started in 2023, Chicago's diverted more than 700 tons of food scraps to be turned into beautiful compost for gardening and for landscaping, rather than turning into methane in a landfill. And so some good news on, you know, from Department of Streets and Sanitation that this compost program is happening.
Wait, okay, let's step back here. We're talking about signups, we're talking about composting. How does it actually, if I'm a Chicago resident, how does composting work?
Okay. So, Patrick, what's your neighborhood?
Logan Square, which apparently you have much disdain for. I heard that in
Well,
your voice.
Okay. These hipsters.
Easy
hipsters. Lots of hipsters in your neighborhood.
I'm sorry. Are you pro or anti-composting?
No. I'm saying that you guys are so hip that you are the, I think, number three. Mm. No, you're number two. So Lincoln Square, number one with 1,259 sign-ups. Logan Square, 1,070. So you'd go to the city site and say, hey, I'd like to bring my food scraps to my local location. Where is it? They'd say, just walk down the street. It's over there, these green bins. So you bring stuff. Don't bring plastic. Don't even bring compostable bags. I don't like those. But like your carrot shavings, your potato shavings, even an old birthday cake, you can go and put them in there. And then they will take them to a central place, a commercial composter, so you can do bones and cheese and meat, which you can't do in your backyard because it really won't break down that well. They'll bring it to a commercial composter. They'll grind it up, turn it into composting, rather than having the city bring it to a landfill to create methane, which is more powerful than CO2 in terms of its effect on the ozone.
Excellent. Okay. Are you guys composters?
1,000%.
No. Monica has been the compost queen for a very long time. You're the expert in
Why
Chicago media.
Why are you
media.
Guys not bringing your food scraps to your local spot? Come on.
I should be.
Yes, we all should be. Quinn, you have a story this week about the struggles at a well-known private arts high school. Tell us what's happening at the Chicago Academy for the Arts.
Sure. So Chicago Academy for the Arts on Chicago Avenue, Westtown, River West area, longtime performing arts high school, often sees graduates go on to Juilliard, top performing arts colleges, and then professional success, both in Chicago and everywhere. They've seen a pretty steady decline in enrollment since COVID. I spoke with their new head of school, their principal, essentially. She said during COVID and afterwards, when classes were online, it was hard to get kids to enroll when, you know, you can't really dance or perform in an orchestra together, right? And so they've seen a pretty dramatic decline, and they're now facing about $500,000 budget gap going into the rest of this school year and into next. So basically, they're restructuring, offering new programs. They're offering a kind of gap year for students who want to improve their resume and portfolio. They're all, you know, whole range of stuff. And they're trying to basically get back to about 150 students, which was around their pre-COVID numbers, and then hopefully grow that even more. And this also comes as they're going to have to move. You know, this is they've been in their current building. You might recognize it on Chicago near Ogden and Milwaukee. They've been there since 1990. The Catholic Church that is next to them is their landlord. And they basically said, in 2 years, we want this building back. Don't know why. I asked them. Haven't heard back. But they said, hey, we're going to give you 2 years, but, you know, you're going to have to move. So this school is in the process of moving at the same time as they're dealing with this budget shortfall. So they have seen some new donations, and so I do hope that they can, you know, right the ship. And this is a really vital and really unique school that not many places don't have a place like this. Chicago Academy for the Arts is really a kind of, you know, beacon for the arts, especially amongst youth in Chicago.
Is there, okay, so are they chalking all this up enrollment-wise to COVID? Are there other trends happening here?
I think it's been tough for a lot of private schools to maintain enrollment, so I think they're kind of in on that as well. You know, they also give it's not cheap to go here, but they do give tuition aid to about 70% of their students, and they have been getting these kind of one-time grants. You know, anyone who is like a nonprofit, you know, or works with grants knows that, you know, it's great to get these big grants, but it's not necessarily always the most sustainable for operating costs. You need that kind of regular money coming in, whether it's subscriptions for a newspaper or tuition for a school, right? So they're kind of dealing with what a lot of similar institutions are going through.
And, you know, I'll remind everyone, yesterday was Local News Day. Remind you to become a WBEZ or Sun-Times member, become a Block Club member, sign up for the Axios newsletter. One more thing before we take a quick break. Rainbow Push, obviously founded by Reverend Jesse Jackson in 1996, has a new leader, Caitlin Phillison.
Yeah, Yousef Jackson has officially taken over Rainbow Push. This was long in the making. This is also something his father wanted before he passed. This is something that the board of Rainbow Push unanimously approved. Yousef had already been in a leadership role for the last 2 years. He was chief operating officer. So this was a very natural move for the organization.
You know, I'll be honest. I know you say this was long in the making. He was, I think, chief operational officer before this. This is what his dad wanted. I was a little surprised he hasn't kind of been more public. I mean, obviously, I knew who he was, but I don't feel like he had been sort of in recent years been elevated to more of a public figure. Is Yousef Jackson somebody that you guys have like seen out and about and speaking on topics that his dad also spoke on?
Not as much as his brothers, who one is in Congress, one unsuccessfully ran for Congress and was previously in Congress, right? But I mean, I've definitely heard the name, but he is not as high profile as some of his siblings and certainly his dad.
Yeah. I sat next to him at a couple dinner parties.
Okay.
Delightful gentleman.
Oh, well, glad to hear it. He's actually going to be on In the Loop on Wednesday. Sasha and Simons will be back in the host chair to interview Yousef Jackson on In the Loop on Wednesday. This week, the Chicago Park District and Chicago's Department of Cultural Affairs launched the Monument Response Project. Monica, what is this about?
Well, you right on this very show this week, Hector Gonzalez and Sonia Henderson talked about their art. So you know how we had that whole period where it's like, let's take down this statue and this one, you know, they're all problematic. Well, there was a commission that took a look at them and actually decided that 41 statues had some issues with them, and then they recommended different remedies. Some were, take it down, but others were, hey, let's put some context around this. And so they put out these calls for artists to make that context, and it launched this week called the Monument Response Project, and they're responding to monuments. So actually not far from me, I rode my little bike down to Belmont and the lake where, you know, you probably see that Sheridan statue like on the horse. And Sheridan, a lot of people think of General Philip Sheridan as like this like really good general, which is why we have a statue. But I guess he, during his campaigns against Southern Plains tribes, killed a whole lot of bison and buffalo. And I didn't know that. So there's this whole tribute to bison and buffalo at the foot of it by Sonia Henderson. With like a soundscape, which would be great for radio if you guys can capture that, which is like to the tune of mushrooms or something. I wasn't sure what that meant. And then the other one is really cool. It's a guy on a horse. He's a Native American and Mexican American. He's got a boombox on his arm, Jordans on his feet, a Chicago t-shirt, and he's in front of the statue of a Native American called Signal of Peace, and that's at Diversity in the Lake. And so there are these QR codes where you can get more information right there, and I've got photos in the Axios newsletter where you can sort of see these juxtaposed statues. But it's a really interesting way to get local artists involved in kind of putting context around what this commission deemed as problematic statues.
Yeah, I saw your piece and your photos. Nice work, by
Thank
the way.
You.
And I like it. You know, there are times where statues should just come down, but it's nice to have these other situations where, okay, if there are things that need context to be responded to, let's have some new public art to do that as well. I really like that. And as you mentioned, we talked about this on In the Loop. Sasha Ann Simon spoke to a couple folks working on this Monument Response Project earlier this week. Here's what Michael Dimitroff, manager of art initiatives for the Chicago Park District, had to say about it.
History is not going to be removed, replaced. Things happened. People reacted, but here we are 150 years later, and there's an interpretation that can be modified and embellished in the right way. And so truth, bringing truth and the whole story back to power.
Okay, so speaking of bringing truth and the whole story back to power, on Wednesday, Congressman Jesus Chuy Garcia announced plans to rename the Cesar Chavez post office in Pilsen. This comes after a New York Times investigation found extensive evidence that Chavez groomed and sexually abused girls as young as 12 and 13 during his time leading the United Farm Workers Movement. Quinn, I could see this as a teachable moment in civics class. It's also a gut-wrenching history lesson to grapple with.
Absolutely, and I think we're seeing this around the country, and there's also another park district property or something else named after Chavez that I think is being considered to be being renamed. And, you know, I think it was really shocking, these revelations, for a lot of people who saw Cesar Chavez as a hero for workers, for Latinos across the country. And so, you know, the city is grappling with it. I think a lot of people who saw him as a hero mostly support the renaming of the post office, of other sites, because they say this, you know, this is a huge moment where we can't just do nothing. We can't just let this go by.
Yeah, I mean, as you mentioned, a handful of Chavez murals in Chicago have been removed or replaced with designs honoring Dolores Huerta, who's Chavez's longtime ally. Dolores Huerta told the New York Times that Chavez sexually assaulted her as well. The Illinois Senate is actually going to replace Cesar Chavez Day with Farm Workers Day on March 31st, and they're going to declare today, April 10th, as Dolores Huerta Day in Illinois. Today is her birthday. She turns 96. Monica, what do you make of the way Chicago and Illinois are reacting to the allegations, the evidence, the revelations about Chavez?
Well, the New York Times story, you know, was years in the making. And so I believe that they've gone above and beyond what's needed to really kind of prove this issue. And so across the nation, this is happening. And I think that Illinois is reacting appropriately.
Yeah. I mean, Caitlin, it seems like this monument response project is happening, is really timely. We're exploring issues around who exactly should be honored and how.
Absolutely. I'm actually a California kid. So I grew up learning about Cesar Chavez from as young as I was like 8 years old in third grade. You first start learning. So and the whole farm worker movement was taught around him. And so I think it's a good lesson to learn about, you know, movements have leaders, but at the end of the day, it's a collective action. And so I think that's why it's great that, like, I mean, California, I'd always have his birthday off in school. Mm-hmm. And that's now, which is March 31st, which is the day here too. But, you know, calling it Farm Workers Day, I think is definitely adequate because it recognizes that it was a lot of people who were behind that movement, and especially in California.
Yeah, that's a conversation we had here on Say More, which is, you know, that the elevating of individuals, it's something that happens a lot. It's kind of natural, but there's also real dangers to that as well. I'm skeptical that we've learned that lesson broadly, but certainly we're seeing people at least trying to respond to what we've learned most recently. We're going to really turn this bus in a different direction and close with some fun. Monica, the legendary Lakeview Nightclub Berlin is reopening under a new name, actually two new names. Can you tell us about this?
Sure. It's going to be a cocktail bar called Belmont in the early evening and then late night. It's going to be called Decibel or DB, but a lot of people don't know that sign, you know. People who worked at the former club are working with the new owners to open it up again, hopefully on April 25th, pending final city approval. I toured the place. It looks like the old Berlin, but with clean bathrooms, new lighting, a new DJ booth, new stuff behind the bar. They say that it's going to capture the old spirit of being friendly to LGBTQ people, straight clubbers, as long as everybody respects everybody. And they do believe it's going to capture that old inclusive vibe with great music and late night dancing, pending city final.
I appreciate you saying that. Yeah. Berlin obviously was a special place and had a special meaning. Is it going to be hard to recapture that even with a new place in the same spot?
Well, TBD, and that's what a lot of people are saying on my social media. I don't know if it's going to be the same. I'll check it out. A lot of people are very happy to hear the bathrooms have been remodeled. But, you know, the new managers tell me that it's going to have that Berlin vibe of acceptance, of great music, of a lot of retro house 80s, 90s techno tunes. You know, probably some New Order in there that I will be dancing to. But I'm excited.
Excellent. Let's go ahead, Quinn.
I was just say, you know, whenever a place closes and reopens, people are always like, it's not the same. And I think that's an unrealistic expectation. I think, you know, it can honor what came before, but also has to kind of become its own thing too.
What's going on with the Twisted Spoke?
Good question. So the Twisted Spoke, the old biker and whiskey bar at Grand and Ogden, around for 30 years, closed last year. It is becoming Soccer House, an exclusive soccer bar. They're going to show multiple soccer games at one time, just in time for the World Cup, which is coming up this summer. And they have the rooftop beer garden will be opening shortly. But the bar itself is going to reopen on April 18th. That's a week from tomorrow. So fun spot in Westtown, especially if you're a soccer fan. And they have a full food menu, too.
Okay, this is a boozy segment. It's been 10 years since the state re-legalized happy hours. Monica, you took a look at some of the best bargains around town. Really tough assignment for you. But actually, before you tell us the best deals, tell us the backstory. When did they ban happy hours? Why did they unban them?
It was seen as, you know, something that could be dangerous, that people could get loaded before they drive back to Wilmette, and that would be a problem. And then they unbanned them, probably with a lot of tavern lobbying pressure. And so I have something called the Happy Hour Hop, where I check out the most intriguing happy hours in town. It's a tough job, but you guys have to come with me next time. Some of the cheapest, can you believe this? Most happy hours are early, but at RJ Grunt's, I believe they happen from 7 to 10, I think Thursday through. You got to check my story. But $5 Amaretto Sours, margaritas, old fashions, $5? Wow. They don't have food deals. And some of the best food deals I found, okay, well, one is a $1 slice of pizza at Trader Todd's. It tastes like a $1 slice of pizza. But you can also do karaoke, and it's like a $5 margarita with that. But then somewhat like Il Porcellino has got fantastic meatballs, and that's over there in River North. For a kind of fancy one, you can go to La Grande Boucherie, where you can get oysters and escargot in this super fancy bar. I've got like 20 of them in my store. You can check it out.
Very important question. Do any start at 10 a.m. on Fridays?
No, that's an early hour, but some of them are 7 days a week.
Okay. Caitlin and Quinn, you guys have any happy hour deals favorite bars you go to?
I'm going to one tonight. Pompette at Armitage and Damon.
Okay.
They've got a great happy hour, great burger. My boyfriend and I love it. We're going to go. They also have on tap vermouth, which I only encounter in Spain, which is pretty cool.
Where it's vermouth.
Vermouth, yes. Or it's like it's vermouth, it's bottled, excuse me, it's not on tap. But they have it on the happy hour menu for a very fair price, which is pretty cool.
I know you started at 5 a.m. today. Are you going to take a nap before you go out for happy hour?
Hopefully. Oh, yeah, I'm about to crash in an hour and a half.
I like Table Donkey Stick in Logan Square. It has a really good, you know, kind of a fancier restaurant, but from 5 to 7, they have really good deals on burgers and beers and other drinks. So
love that place.
Check it out.
Okay.
My birthday.
All right. Real quick, everybody, before I let you all go, I like to ask, Sasha likes to ask usually, but today I'm going to ask, what stories are you going to be watching for next week? Caitlin, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I'm sticking on the West Sub story. I'm working on a story talking to active patients who have been directly impacted by the hospital closing. I found a few folks to reach out to, but if anyone has anything that they'd like to share, if they are a patient, you can reach me. You can find my email, kwashburn@suntimes.com.
I'm looking at data center legislation in Springfield under the Power Act, and as negotiations happen, what kind of requirements will we put on data centers in the future?
I'm keeping an eye on a few city council things. There's a lot of money supposedly coming to the Lathrop Homes redevelopment. People will know that's been sitting partially vacant for a long time. So hopefully this is finally going to move forward so more people can find housing.
That is Quinn Myers of Block Club Chicago, Monica Eng of Axios, and Caitlin Washburn of the Sun-Times. Thank you, everybody, for breaking down the news with me, and have a great weekend.
This episode of the In the Loop podcast was produced by me, Andrea Guffman, and edited by Ethan Schwab. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/InTheLoop. Thanks for listening.